So as I have said, I have some international listeners now and again. But you know who never listens in? Canada. And they're not even that far. I mean, what the hell, man? Did somebody put a tariff on my podcast when I wasn't looking? Speaking of politicians, I read a great... Here we go again. I read a great quote from the first vice president and the second P, or second president, himself, John Adams. And Paul Giamatti played John Adams in the seven-part miniseries John Adams on HBO in 2008. Seven-part miniseries on John Adams? I say hell no. But anyway, the clever-ass quote from John Adams was, "One useless man is a shame, two is a law firm, and three or more is a Congress." Ouch, my man is on fire. All right, play that funky music, white boy.
You are my density. You are my density.
So my mom and I are driving to Los Angeles tomorrow to look at apartments. So yes, it's that time I have to pack my fucking vitamin envelopes. God, it's becoming a chore, but I'm addicted. What can I say? I think I read somewhere, or maybe imagined it, that William S. Burroughs, the famous and notorious heroin addict, author of 1953's Junkie, which I actually read when I was younger because it's quite a short read. Anyway, I think he said that there's nothing worse than a vitamin addict, which I have to agree with. I mean, if you're addicted to heroin, you want heroin or some opiate. With vitamins and supplements, there's always more. There's always something new to add to the arsenal. I read life extension magazines and look up supplement research on PubMed. And, you know, I feel pretty energetic and healthy for my age, aside from the anxiety, depression, and self-loathing. But the thing is, when I add something, I never really know what supplement is actually doing what. So therefore, it's kind of hard for me to take supplements out of the protocol because it's always like, well, maybe that's the one that's doing the magic. It's a bit of a shotgun approach. Bringing back William S. Burroughs, he did some shotgun art, where he had a shotgun, put cans of paint in front of plywood, and then shot them. And then he added some other pictures and stuff on top of that plywood. It looks kind of interesting. And while speaking of William S. Burroughs and guns, he famously shot and killed his second wife, Joan Vollmer, in Mexico City in 1951 while accidentally shooting her while drunkenly attempting a William Tell stunt. I guess he received a 2-year suspended sentence. And I had forgotten about the story of William Tell. I had to look it up. It's kind of awesome. I mean, he was a symbol of Swiss independence. The story goes that this Austrian lawman named Gessler put a hat on a pole and ordered the Swiss townspeople to bow to it. I guess it was an Austrian hat. William Tell refused, and Gessler ordered Tell to shoot an apple off his son's head with a single arrow from his crossbow. Well, he succeeded and split the apple in half. He supposedly had a second arrow drawn, and Gessler asked why. And William Tell said if he had hit his son, the second arrow would be used to kill Gessler. I mean, that's some, like, true diehard badassery shit. And speaking of other badasses, my mom had a wet mop thing that she wanted to throw away, but she couldn't take it apart so it fit in the trash. So I took it. I went outside and said, in this situation, you should say, what would Liam Neeson do? Or WWLND. Well, that's not very catchy. So anyway, I held the mop up and then violently slammed my foot against it right in the middle, and the thing just crumpled in half. Usually my life is more full of Jerry Lewis-type moments, but every once in a while, however fleetingly, I have Liam Neeson moments. But I would say as a whole, my life is more of an Albert Brooks-style movie. You know, a relatively likable character, funny at times, always looking for love, and overly dependent on his mother. This could be right out of an Albert Brooks movie. Almost every time I call my mom, which isn't very often, yeah, right, more like 2 times a day, but generally the first time I call her, she isn't able to pick up the phone. It either goes to message or she can't hear me. She also has an Apple Watch, so half the time it goes to that fucking thing. And my mom isn't very computer savvy. She has a PC, but an iPhone and an Apple Watch and an iPod, and the shit is always conflicting with each other and fighting each other. She has music on her PC, but not on the phone, but it's on the iPod, but the fucking thing updates, but this one doesn't. And the iPad does, and she has like 1 nanomegabyte of storage left on her phone for some goddamn reason. And I try to clean up her stuff when I come over, but I'm no computer genius. And I really only know how to use Macs. When I try to use a PC, it's like me trying to speak a foreign language. It's like, what, control, alt, what the fuck? And as we speak, I sit at my mom's in the little side bedroom writing this podcast while she's in the other room watching TV. Sometimes I think, man, my life is pathetic. But I'm glad I have this goofy little podcast to keep me occupied. I enjoy doing this every week, and it gives my life a little bit of a purpose. I mean, besides saving the world, of course. I read a great little paragraph in the New York Times magazine. It was kind of an article about weirdos and stuff who kind of do their own thing. The article by Hanya Yanagihara ended by saying that what these weirdos share is a determination to do things their way, see things their way. It's not always easy to chart your own course. You can be mocked. You can risk harm. But it's worth it. The freest person isn't the richest or the prettiest. It's the person who within them has created their own world, and they are its ruler. Now, isn't that good? I mean, we have the ability to create our own world and also to build ourselves up and to destroy ourselves as well. As Tom Robbins said, we are our own dragons as well as our own heroes, and we have to rescue ourselves from ourselves. Rest in peace, good sir. A fun fact and some movies, and that's it for this week. I've got to start packing my goddamn vitamin envelopes for this trip, remember? Okay, here's one of those little anecdotes. Is it an anecdote? Probably not. But anyway, so how long would it take to count out loud to a million? Speaking normally, and for the sake of argument, let's say it's several people doing this in shifts because you've got to sleep and eat and piss and stuff. Or, you know what? Hey, let's just say, how long would it take a robot to count to a million? Counting one number over a second, roughly. And it would take about 11 days and almost 14 hours to count to a million. Okay, I guess that makes sense. Now get ready for this. How long does it take to count to a billion? Any guesses out there? Just under 32 years. I mean, holy shit, that blows my mind. I mean, that's a lot of counting, and I guess I get it, but it still seems unfathomable to me. But you know, it's a fun fact to have in a reserve if needed. So a few movies. My mom and I watched the ridiculous but enjoyable Runaway Jury from 2003, directed by a pro Gary Fletter, or Fleeter, I'm not sure how to say his name. He also did the kind of cool noir Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead from 1995 with Andy Garcia, Christopher Walken, and a knockout Gabrielle Anwar. Runaway Jury is a big, twisty courtroom drama, pretty massive movie with John Cusack, Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman, and Rachel Weisz. And shame on you, Rachel Weisz, for having an S and then a Z on your last name. We're Americans. We don't know how to pronounce that. Anyway, you've probably seen it. It's about a lawsuit against a big gun manufacturer. Hackman is an evil jury consultant trying to threaten the jury to vote for the gun company. John Cusack is a juror who is much more involved than he seems. It comes together pretty well. And John Cusack is supposedly a bit of a dick in person. He's another one of those guys who had a hair transplant, but he kind of doesn't do the upkeep very well, so you will see him with just some awful fucking hair at times. And I may have mentioned this before, but I was shopping in a Gap store on Melrose Avenue in Hollywood around 1996, and John Cusack, wearing a bandana, breathlessly walked in, presumably stoned. He seemed kind of paranoid, jittery, and he was asking where someone was, and then he just, like, walked out. And I was like, what in the fuck just happened? But anyway, if you haven't seen Runaway Jury, do see it. It's a big, well-done, fun ride. Speaking of good hair, although I'm still not 100% convinced it's real, I watched the new Frank Grillo movie, Werewolves, from 2024, directed by Stephen C. Miller, who also did the kind of enjoyable horror comedy killer Santa Claus movie from 2012 called Silent Night with Malcolm McDowell and Jamie King. I haven't seen it for a bit, but I do remember liking it. And I remember seeing the actress Jamie King at an indie rock show in Los Angeles, God, probably in the 90s. That was probably my peak attractiveness, and I swear she was checking me out. And I hadn't yet cultivated that boldness of going up and talking to anyone. That came later, like when I drunkenly gushed over Mia Jovovich at a Lollapalooza in Chicago while her then-boyfriend Jeremy Davies sat silently stewing. Well, anyway, back to Werewolves. Well, what can I say? It's a dumbass plot, fairly bad effects, and I liked it. It's kind of enjoyably bad and brought me back to the kind of movie I loved as a kid. The practical werewolf effects are fairly shitty, but who cares? There was a fairly surprising and kind of awesome twist at the end, though I wish they would have followed up on it. The very ending is kind of a cop-out. But, you know, it's got Frank Grillo doing his usual Frank Grillo thing, and it's got a fairly unrecognizable Lou Diamond Phillips. Your mileage may vary, but I say check it out. Okay, lastly, I watched the new Errol Morris documentary on Charles Manson called Chaos, The Manson Murders, which is loosely based on the book from 2019 called Chaos, Charles Manson, The CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, written by Tom O'Neill and Dan Plimpering, probably mispronounced that, and the movie features Tom O'Neill. And every time they showed him, I could only think of Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, watch the documentary. This guy resembles Epstein. Am I nuts? Is it a conspiracy? Is Epstein still alive? No, but really, the documentary delves a little bit into Tom O'Neill's research, which features some like CIA, MKUltra, mind control shit, LSD, and some other conspiracies. But after you watch this documentary, at the end of the day, all of the conspiracy speculation is a bit of a thin gruel. I think ultimately Charles Manson was a charismatic, enigmatic character who was able to attract people who were looking to be led. And through a healthy dose of sex, intimidation, and a lot of drugs, Manson was able to convince his followers to commit murder for him. Manson was a criminal creature who operated by the laws of the jungle. He was a paranoid freak and a terrible songwriter who had his friends commit heinous acts of murder, not only for him to have some leverage against his friends, but also for the failed songwriter to exact some revenge on the Hollywood music scene that ultimately rejected him. Here's how I see it. Firstly, the music teacher Gary Hinman, who was kind of friends by Manson, was killed by Bobby Beausoleil, one of Manson's gang. Manson basically ordered the murder, and Beausoleil, still imprisoned, came to regret it. Now, Manson had some dumb shit idea of invoking a race war where black Americans would rise up, but somehow Manson and his family would remain in power. So after this murder, Manson probably knew there would be a connection between Gary Hinman, who was known to have, you know, associated with Manson and his gang. And so I think Manson probably figured, fuck it, now I can get my revenge on the music industry. I won't get into the minute details, but he had some members of his family go to the Cielo Drive House, formerly occupied by the music producer Terry Melcher, who had rejected Charles Manson, and to kill its occupants. I figure Manson thought Terry Melcher still lived at the Cielo House. Unfortunately, Roman Polanski had been renting the house. He was out of town, but his pregnant wife, Sharon Tate, was there along with a few other people, and they were massacred. And the next night, again, I think just to cloud the picture, Manson randomly picked out a couple in Los Feliz to kill, the LaBiancas. Eventually, the cops found their way to Manson. Some members testified against him, and the killers and him were sent to jail. So anyway, the documentary mentions Manson possibly running across some guy who was doing mind control experiments with the CIA, but it's a pretty loose connection. Also, the cops took a while to arrest Manson when it seemed obvious that his crew was involved. So yes, Manson and his gang may have been some kind of police informants at some point. But to be honest, the whole conspiracy angle in the documentary just doesn't really hold water. It's still an interesting watch, but at the end of the film, my mind remained the same about Manson as before I started the movie. Some weird coincidences, yes, but nothing solid. But it is totally worth watching. And remember, I have some personal experience with the Manson family. As mentioned before, I worked at a video store in Northern California in the early 90s, and a bona fide member of the Manson gang, Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem Tufts, was a frequent customer, and he did the artwork for our store, like signs that said 20 rentals for 10 bucks or whatever. He was a creepy dude, seemed like a dimwit, and like a year or two after I left the video store, I discovered he was in the Manson gang. I saw his picture in the book Helter Skelter, and I was like, holy shit. And Steve Grogan supposedly helped to kill Donald Shorty Shea, who was a ranch hand at the Spawn Ranch, which is where the Manson family holed up. Grogan was sentenced to death, but later the sentence was reduced, and he was released from prison on parole in 1985. And as of 2025, this guy, Steve Grogan, and Leslie Van Houten are the only people who have been released from prison after being convicted of murder and killings committed by the Manson family. So there. Have you ever met anyone from the Manson family? I think not. So that's pretty much all I have for this episode. I'm recording this on Friday, driving to LA for 3 nights tomorrow. So when it posts Tuesday morning, I will have already found an apartment and will be driving back to Sacramento from Los Angeles. Hopefully my visit to LA was successful. I hope I found a good apartment. Did I? I don't know yet. I guess we'll find out next week. And actually, let's end this episode kind of where we began, talking about my listeners. I noticed someone was listening from Zurich, Switzerland, and weird that I mentioned William Tell earlier in this episode, but anyway, I thank you, or Danke, is that correct? I don't know, I hope so. But of course, whenever I see Zurich, I think of one of my favorite bands, Pavement, whose great song Zurich is Stained was on their album Slanted and Enchanted from 1992. Here's a little bit of that, and Gute Nacht. I can't sing it strong enough, 'cause that kind of strength I just don't have. With the watch, the light changed to hold, then hanging. You think it's easy, but you're wrong. I am not one half of the problem. Zurich is stained and it's not my fault. Just hold me back or let me run. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la-la. Oh.